Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Governor DeWine is expected to unveil his budget proposal later today, and then lawmakers will spend the next few months wrangling over the details. But all budgets, past, present, and future, now have an X factor, and that is federal funding. A memo from the Trump administration last week sent many in Ohio scrambling. The memo froze every federal loan and grant program, and it apparently appeared to temporarily cut off funding for states, universities, private companies, and nonprofits. Eventually, the memo was rescinded, but its intent remains. Can Ohio count on the same level of federal funding it's been used to? Joining us to talk budgets, bills, and more is Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Hey, good morning.
And Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks for being here, Laura.
Good morning.
And Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hannah News Service. Welcome, Shane.
Good morning. Happy Budget Day.
Happy Budget Day. So let's start with Governor DeWine's budget. So he is going to set the spending plan for the next 2 years. The unveiling is supposed to happen today, and then lawmakers will spend the next weeks and months negotiating over the details. Now, the budget is a big document. What is something that you will look for that in the budget that indicates this is what's important to the governor? Sarah, you want to start?
Yeah, sure. So my colleague Karen Kassler is reporting that it's set to include the third and final phase of the Fair School Funding Plan, which started in 2021. So I think school funding is going to be a big topic over the next couple of months to watch. You've got lawmakers and leaders who have different ideas about how Ohio schools should be funded. You know, notably, former Senate President and now House Speaker Matt Huffman said that the Fair School Funding Plan was kind of a fantasy, that lawmakers need to look at other options. And then the other thing that I'm going to be looking for are potential tax cuts. You know, this is going to be a leaner budget because the state is not going to have access to federal American Rescue Plan dollars that it's had in the past. So it's going to be a leaner budget. Everyone's been saying it's going to be a leaner budget. And of course, tax cuts often result in less revenue to the state. But there are some GOP lawmakers who have been already saying that they'd really like to see tax cuts.
Yeah, and Shane, what would you be looking for later today?
In addition to the stuff Sarah talked about, all of DeWine's budgets, he's tried to have a focus on like children and family issues. And so I would expect this to be no different. He kind of previewed last week, he did an event out in the Dayton area at Wright State where he was talking about child care. And that's an issue that the business community especially has been pushing on. So I'm going to be interested to see how much of that he includes, especially in a tight budget. I don't know if you can find the funding to start subsidizing more child care for the people who need it most. And, you know, I think you're also going to, I don't know if we'll see the tax cuts. I think that's something that might come in the legislature, but he's called it a normal budget. So there's probably not going to be a lot of huge surprises in it.
Laura, do you know what a normal budget is?
Well, a normal budget is thousands of pages long. It starts out with the governor introducing his proposals. Then it goes through the House, which then, you know, could completely revamp it or definitely put its own spin on it. And then it goes to the Senate. And then they have their conference committee in which just a small subset of people really decide what's going to be in the final budget. And we won't see the final budget until July 1st. So this is kind of a long slog, the very beginning of a long slog. I do expect that like what Shane and Sarah said, that, you know, the focus is going to be children, education. There's only a few things in life that are true, which is, taxes, death, and changes in education policy in Ohio. So pretty sure we'll see some changes on that. And there will be an emphasis on kids.
And more broadly, I'm also watching for, I talked to some mental health advocates back in the fall. They have concerns that because it's a leaner budget, some of those social services could see cuts. And, you know, over the last several budget cycles, DeWine has been very supportive of expanding mental health resources. So also watching for that.
Yeah, I was going to say, if it's going to be a leaner budget, there has to be cuts somewhere. It can't be the same, right? So I was also wondering if there has been any talk about the way the state is funding Medicaid. I know that that's a huge part of the budget.
Yeah, Medicaid is a massive chunk of the budget. It's a state and federally funded program for people who are low income or have disabilities. And I would say that there, we'll probably see, you know, there's a big push to add work requirements to, you know, to qualify for Medicaid benefits. I think that might be incorporated into the budget proposal.
Now, this is Governor DeWine's last budget before he leaves office, before he retires from public life. And you mentioned the child care issue. You mentioned school funding. Is there anything, any legacy items that you think he'll really push? Or if lawmakers push back on him on the child care, he might really push for it because of the legacy?
It's tough to say, and I don't necessarily know. I'm not super up to date on the Expo 2050 funding for the state fair. I know there was some of that in the infrastructure budget, which
Governor DeWine does care about the fair.
He does care about the state fair a lot, and I would say that's like one of the legacy projects for him. He really does want to see, you know, support for this real overhaul of what the state fairgrounds look like. So, I mean, that's me just spitballing and throwing it out there without any sort information, so I want to add that caveat, but those are the types of, you know, potential legacy projects that you could see.
Laura, do you have any legacy ideas besides maybe the child care issue?
I think that Mike DeWine's legacy has been built over, you know, half a century, focused entirely on kids and families and protecting the public. You know, you go back to his days in the U.S. Senate, and he and I think Hillary Clinton co-authored a bill to require the FDA to test drugs' efficacy and safety before deploying them for children. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's that. You know, you look back on his legacy, and it's all about protecting kids. And so, I don't think it's any one big thing that we'll see in the budget. I think it's just more of what we've already seen.
Okay. And related to the school funding, and that relates to the voucher issue, does Governor DeWine and the legislature, are they in agreement on that? Or it seems as though there are different opinions on the way to go about this in the future and the way school funding has been planned out.
Well, you definitely see big support for school vouchers from Speaker Huffman. You know, it remains to be seen the way in which Governor DeWine will work with incoming Finance Chair Representative Brian Stewart. He's obviously been newly named finance chair. So, I mean, you know, DeWine has definitely more recently come head to head on some issues with a lot of the GOP caucus that's in the legislature right now. So we'll see.
Well, and the, I mean, the voucher program is expected. It came in a lot higher, I think, than what many expected. It might reach over $1 billion in a tighter budget where you don't have all the extra federal funds from the American Rescue Plan. In this time, that could create some tension in the negotiations.
And I mentioned at the beginning, you know, talking about federal action as it relates to the state budget. So President Trump's executive order to freeze federal grants and loans through Ohio and other states into sudden uncertainty when about whether major state-level programs and services could be interrupted or even reduced. About 30% of Ohio's general fund does come from federal sources. So I this last week was kind of a whirlwind of how everything happened when regarding the memo from the Trump administration, then the lawsuits, and then the rescinding of the memo. That can throw the budget into a loop. Because they've been working on it for a while, right, Laura?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we see a return to this broad sweeping, let's freeze all the federal grants and loans, that's a big monkey wrench into the state budget process. I think that the memo, the freezing, unfreezing, really kind of showed us in stark relief how much federal money is intertwined with all kinds of stuff, everything from, school lunches to intel to basic scientific research. Mm-hmm. We'll see. I think that the Trump administration in making that move tried to kind of demonstrate that it is trying to deliver on a campaign promise to reduce waste, fraud, and abuse in federal spending. But it took kind of more of a sledgehammer approach than a surgical approach. And so I would expect that they're still going to try to do that, to try to say that we're cutting back on wasteful spending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure that the budget that DeWine brings out today at 4 o'clock includes federal funding, or takes into account federal funding. So, not that you can predict the future, Sarah, but I'm sure it'll come up in his conversation when he presents it.
Yeah. Absolutely, it has to. But like Laura said, what I'm looking at more so with this, freeze, unfreeze of federal funding and potential cuts to federal funding in different areas are those projects like Intel. You saw the rush at the end of the Biden administration to get CHIPS Act money actually dispersed so that, the Biden administration was quote unquote delivering on its promises. You've got very early stage Amtrak projects that are reliant on federal grants in Ohio. Those could absolutely, not come to fruition if they don't have that federal funding piece. So I'm looking definitely at a lot of these public-private partnerships that rely heavily on federal funding, and less so, the budget is absolutely affected by federal funding, but those longer-term decisions that, it remains to be seen how the Trump administration might affect them.
And Shane, I'm sure last week was fun for everyone, just watching all of the volleying back and forth about what's going on with the money. What are your thoughts on federal funding coming up today with the budget release?
At this point, it's probably not going to be a huge discussion. I'm sure there will be questions about it. What happened last week, too, was kind of in the eye of the beholder. There were groups and Democrats making a huge deal about it. The Republicans were kind of a little more silent. Office of Budget Management told us that it really didn't affect anything right then and there for the state of Ohio, because most of it had to deal with federal operations.
Until the Medicaid website stopped working.
Right. They kind of got quickly resolved through them rescinding it and the federal judge putting a stop to it. But that's going to be an ongoing discussion throughout the spring, I'm sure.
This is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable on All Sides, and we're talking with Laura Bischoff of the Columbus Dispatch, Shane Stegmiller of Hanna News Service, and Sarah Donaldson with the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Another thing being talked about in the Ohio Senate is the flat tax bill, flattening the income tax. Right now, the state has a two-bracket tax system, but this bill would eventually flatten that system into one and have everyone paying the same rate, 2.75%. So, Sarah, you wrote about this idea of flattening the tax. Why do lawmakers want to have everyone pay the same amount?
Yeah, so it's GOP lawmakers who have introduced this idea in the past, and they argue that we're not competitive with surrounding states because we don't have a flat income tax like a lot of our neighboring states. The only one of five of Ohio's neighboring states that doesn't have a flat income tax rate is West Virginia. Everyone else has a flat income tax rate. That being said, the income tax in every other state surrounding Ohio is also higher. So they say that by bringing folks who are making six figures or more to that flat 2.75% that everyone who's under six figures is currently paying, they will hopefully reinvest their money back into Ohio. That's kind of the idea of a flat income tax. It spurs revenue in other ways, even though it has an immediate cut on direct tax revenue.
I think this is going to end up being a point of contention between the governor and the lawmakers, because the governor has said in comments last week that he's not heard from businesses that the income tax is a big hurdle to moving to Ohio or expanding in Ohio. So he doesn't see it as an issue, and I don't think he supports going to a flat tax.
And I think this is also something that lawmakers like Senator George Lang, he sees it as a bridge to eventually eliminating the income tax in Ohio, which is something that GOP lawmakers have talked about, and Governor DeWine has thrown cold water on. So I definitely see that as a down-the-line thing, but under DeWine, we'll see.
So if you have everyone paying the flat tax, where do you make up the money, they're saying, in sales tax? Is that what they're...
They argue that initially it will spur, because folks who are making more than six figures will have a little bit more in their pockets. They'll reinvest it back in Ohio businesses. But the idea with eliminating the income tax, when you look at other states that have eliminated income taxes, they obviously become much more reliant on other taxes like the sales tax.
This has been a part of an effort, though, that they've been working towards over the past decade or so. I mean, I think they had like five different brackets, and now they're down, the last budget, I think, brought it down to two. So they've been aiming for this for a long time. There is a question of how much it will impact the budget, though, and whether or not they have to put in another tax to take care of the shortfall. Chair Blessing, who's the Ways and Means chairman, said he did research on a previous proposal that was for a 2.5% flat tax rate. And he said that it appeared that it would be a $1.5 billion hit to the state revenue fund. Of course, the sponsors say, well, we're going to make that up because there will be more investment because there's more, you know, it's a more competitive environment.
And just a final question on the budget before we move on, Laura. So if it's being presented today, does the governor do like a big presentation, or does he just kind of talk about his key points and then send the big stack of paper to the lawmakers?
Both.
Yeah,
there's going to be some sort of a press event at 4 o'clock.
Okay, so we'll have to see what's actually in it and the reaction from everyone. And coming up, we're going to talk about lawmakers taking another stab at changing the marijuana laws, and we'll also discuss the future of the death penalty in Ohio. That's when the Reporter Roundtable continues on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. A First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk about all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This week for our Reporter Roundtable, we have Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks again for being here, Laura.
Hey, hey. Thanks.
And Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hannah News Service. Thanks again for being here, Shane.
Thank you.
And Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. Happy Monday.
So for more than a year, lawmakers have toyed with the idea of making changes to the voter-approved law that legalized recreational marijuana. And this time, they may actually do it. A new proposal would increase the tax rate from 10% to 15%, and it would ban people from smoking marijuana in public, reduce the number of homegrown plants. There's a lot of things in this bill. Do you think that this bill has legs? Sarah, you want to start?
Yeah. Absolutely. I think it has legs. Ohio Senate President Rob McCauley, he was integral to kind of coming up with some of these proposals, because this isn't the first time that a lot of these changes have been proposed. They came in a 2023 overhaul bill that the Senate passed, and then the House did nothing with. So McCauley, Senate president now, he says he wants to fast track this. And Speaker Matt Huffman is also very supportive of overhauling changes to the state's recreational marijuana program. It remains to be seen. I mean, some of the differences in opinion over in the House, because you've got lawmakers who are in rural districts who, you know, serve to benefit from the industry that is recreational marijuana. So we'll have to see how they feel about that. There was a lot of backlash to that cutback of home grow when they first proposed that back in 2023, because initially, back in 2023, lawmakers were going from 12 plants to 2 plants. Now we're up to 6 per household. So, you know, it's definitely a compromise from some of these more aggressive changes that they wanted to see in 2023, but there's still a lot in there that changes.
How do you even regulate that, whether someone has 12 plants, 6 plants, or 100 plants in their house? I guess only if they get in trouble, then they know how many you have.
Yeah, and that part remains to be seen, and it's something that Democratic Senator Bill DeMora told me he's worried about, not only with home grow, but also with some of the legal restrictions on, like, you know, driving with marijuana in the car. He says he's a senator from the Columbus area. He says he's talked to Columbus police officers who say they're not going to prosecute marijuana crimes. They're not worried about marijuana. Mm. But then you go to small communities that may not be thrilled that marijuana is legal in Ohio, and maybe you do see some more prosecution. So he's wondering if there's going to be that unequal playing field where in more urban areas, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to get in trouble for smoking a joint on the side of the street. And I could be wrong. I could be wrong. But, you know, there's definitely that question. Yeah.
The idea that they're going to, you know, prohibit smoking marijuana in public spaces like a park or a sidewalk or whatever is pretty funny. If you just take a walk around town and, you know, give a whiff, you know, you smell marijuana everywhere all the time. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure how they're going to police that. And also, I think this whole thing raises the question about respecting the will of the voters. I mean, the voters were very clear and said, this is what we want. We want 12 home grow. We want, you know, we want this tax rate, et cetera. And this is a pretty major revamping of that bill, of what the voters approved.
That's what I was wondering. So voters approve the marijuana bill, but then lawmakers have the power to just do whatever they want afterward. They can regulate it however they want.
That's the downfall in the state-initiated statute mechanism. You know, you can do all this work, collect a first batch of signatures, submit your proposal to the legislature, and then when they ignore it or change it, then go back, get another big batch of signatures, go to the ballot, campaign, get your voters on your side, et cetera, et cetera. And then within like 10 minutes, they could just go, that's nice, we're changing that law.
Yeah, to be clear, like they had plenty of time before 2023 to give input on what ended up on the ballot. I mean, this was a long process before 2023 as well to even get it on the ballot. And, you know, of course, when you go to that question of kind of the will of the voters, I think lawmakers have different ideas about the will of the voters. I think a lot of Republican lawmakers who oppose the legalization of marijuana will tell you that Ohioans voted for recreational marijuana. They didn't read the proposal and they don't really care about the details. I mean, that's what Republican lawmakers have told me when we've asked about, you know, well, this makes changes to this. Some say they don't really care about the tax structure. They just want access to these products.
Yeah, but Shane, they'll care about the details if the tax is 15% instead of 10. I mean, everything will cost more.
It will. It will. And one of the other huge kind of differences in this proposal that might move is all the money would go state and right into the general revenue fund, which is just the, where they can use it forever, versus the proposal that was passed had a whole bunch of targeted different areas that it would go to. And Senator DeMore also raised that concern, saying that there's no way I'm going to vote for something where we just throw everything into a giant pot that can go for whatever. Mm.
There's also the question of if you raise the tax rate to 15 up from 10, are we competitive with other states? Or does the legal market, you know, are the prices too high and it pushes people back to the black market or to go buy their marijuana products in Michigan or elsewhere?
And not only with the tax rate, but they're also talking about lowering the concentration of products. Mm-hmm. So you can also go buy more concentrated products at a cheaper price in Michigan. And I'm, of course, just saying that because I've heard from consumers who say they still are making their semi-illegal trips to Michigan because of that market. So it's, I mean, you already saw prices that were really high in Ohio just because that's how the market works when something new comes to the market. But adding that excise tax on would certainly bring them up.
Well, and if you go to Michigan to buy it or you find it's too expensive in Ohio and so you buy it not from a reputable store, then you have problems with the regulation of it then.
And of course, too, I mean, and I don't want to get too into the details because all of this could change. I mean, I think this bill is being fast tracked. McCauley says he wants to move it fast, but I think that there could be changes. It also like puts a ceiling on how many dispensaries Ohio can have. So it really does just, I mean, a lot of it are more limitations rather than expanding the law.
And what about the Department of Commerce? They're the ones implementing all these rules. So I guess things are getting more complicated on a daily basis for the Department of Commerce. Or if this bill passes, then the Department of Commerce has to change everything that they just implemented.
Well, one of the things I was going to cover this afternoon was the controlling board, which is the panel of state legislators who kind of oversee some of this spending. It got delayed, actually. I think they're going to try and reschedule it for the 12th. But one of the items on the agenda was the Department of Commerce asking for more money more appropriation to be able to implement more of the marijuana stuff that's come up.
So the Department of Commerce is saying they need maybe more staff or...
More staff and more resources, more equipment. And that staff was, I think, a huge part of the request. But yeah, they were asking for more. I don't know if it was more money, but more the authority to spend more money so that they could have all the resources they need to implement.
Yeah.
Everything.
And I mean, Shane, I read your story about the controlling board. Can we back up a second? And what is the controlling board?
So the controlling board is a panel of three legislators from the House, three legislators from the Senate, and someone from the administration. It's kind of an extra little oversight on the spending of state agencies. Certain contracts have to go through it. Certain spending amounts. If an agency is going to kind of go above and beyond what was given to them in the budget, they have to go through this. It's just kind of an extra layer of oversight that the legislature put on spending by the administration.
So an extra layer of bureaucracy, but very also, maybe boring, but important.
Maybe boring and important. They're very, they like to pull up agency representatives and ask them about things of no bid contracts. Why is this? Why is an out-of-state vendor getting this contract versus an Ohio-based vendor? That's a lot of what you get seen.
You want to add about the controlling board, Sarah?
Well, I was just going to say, when you talk about the Department of Commerce going back to the controlling board, and this is a little bit in the weeds, no pun intended, for where we're at with
policy.
But, dispensaries are still operating under what issue to pass. There are a lot of things that... we're legal under the medical program, that are legal under the recreational program. But there are also things like, we're not selling pre-rolls in Ohio. And that's something that the Department of Commerce still has a lot of work ahead to put forward these rules so that dispensaries can sell pre-rolls and they can sell certain other things. So there's still a lot of work for them that, of course, if the legislature passes an overhaul, that throws an entire wrench into the whole thing.
Laura, any thoughts on the controlling board before we move on? I didn't want to not give you a chance to talk about the controlling board.
No, I think the controlling board is sometimes a window for reporters to find out what agencies are doing because all kinds of things pop up there.
So another bill that I wanted to discuss, there's a new proposal to end the death penalty in Ohio, but this time supporters have linked it also to abortion rights. The measure proposed by a group of Republican and Democratic lawmakers would end capital punishment in Ohio, and it would prohibit state funding for abortions and assisted suicides. So thoughts on this bill? There has not been an execution due to lack of lethal injection drugs, but also there is for 7 years. So there has not been an execution while Mike DeWine was governor.
Yeah, I think that's it's definitely due to a lack of lethal injection drugs, but some lawmakers on the right side of the spectrum have also proposed expanding to using nitrogen gas like other states have. So I think that you would see from both sides that lawmakers argue that it's also just an unofficial moratorium on under Governor Mike DeWine on executions. He has said there's not going to be any executions under him. So I think it's a little bit of a line in the sand for DeWine as well.
Laura, what do you think?
Well, yeah. It's interesting because, the death penalty is an issue that kind of cuts across different partisan lines. Mm-hmm. And you see more conservative Republicans moving to be against the death penalty. Mike DeWine, he helped rewrite the death penalty statute back in 1981 when he was a state senator. You see somebody like Gene Schmidt teaming up with Nikki Antonio. Gene Schmidt is a Republican from Cincinnati. Antonio is the minority leader in the Senate, Democrat from Lakewood. And so it makes for, kind of strange combos. If Ohio were to go ahead and ban the death penalty, it would be a pretty big change. Ohio's had the death penalty since we became a state in 1803, so it's 222 years. The method of execution has changed over time. For the first 80 years or so, they used to just have public hangings in the county where the crime occurred. And then they moved it to the state penitentiary. And then hangings were replaced by electrocution, and electrocution was replaced by lethal injection.
Now, what do you make of this being tied into a bill that would prohibit state funding for abortions and the assisted suicide? Assisted suicide is illegal in Ohio, but the law prohibits tax money from being used to perform abortions.
I think it tries to breathe new life into a proposal that comes up pretty much every 2 years, or at least it has for the last decade. You know, Antonio, Senate Minority Leader Antonio, who Laura mentioned, she's introduced this proposal pretty much every legislative session for the last several legislative sessions. This kind of throws a new twist on it. I imagine the hope is that it brings some conservative Republicans in. But I think, like Laura said, people have pretty strong opinions on the death penalty. They have pretty strongly held opinions on the death penalty. That's not to say that opinions can't change, because Gene Schmidt has done a complete 180 on the death penalty. But I think that it is... I question how much something like this brings people in, because it also isolates some people. Antonio has said this is an exercise in compromise, but no matter how much Antonio says this does not cede ground on abortion rights, abortion advocates have given her a lot of grief for signing on to this proposal. And House Minority Leader Alison Russo has said her caucus is not going to be involved with anything that cedes ground on abortion rights.
Yeah, Laura, what do you make of the abortion part being tied in with the death penalty?
Again, I think Sarah's correct. It's sort of like a way to get more conservative Republicans behind it. You know, we already have a constitutional amendment guaranteeing abortion rights, and we already have a law that prohibits public money being spent on abortions.
I think some of the calculation, too, is... you know, as we've talked about, Governor Mike DeWine has a role in this, and I think what may...
He has a role in the
death. Well, he has a role in what happens with the death penalty over the next 2 years. And I think lawmakers, and I've asked them, Antonio told me in an interview back in November that she really hoped that Governor DeWine would come out and publicly announce his support for ending the death penalty in Ohio. Remains to be seen if he's going to do that. But he did say at a press breakfast back in December that he'd have more to say on it in the coming months. Antonio feels, when we're talking about DeWine's legacy, Antonio feels that if DeWine publicly supports the legislature ending the death penalty, that could turn the tide for some people. And of course, you're looking down the line. You can't rely on who's going to be elected governor, but you've got someone like Attorney General Dave Yost running for governor, who believes that the death penalty is the law of the land. He's publicly expressed his support for expanding options like adding that nitrogen gas thing. So, I mean, the governor does play a role in signing bills and vetoing bills, and you definitely have a governor right now who it seems would be more amenable to signing a bill that ends the death penalty.
It is going to be interesting to see if DeWine actually comes up before his term is up, if he says, yeah, I think we should get rid of the death penalty. Usually it's when governors leave office that they say that.
Okay.
Because didn't both Taft and
Strickland... Taft and Strickland both, I mean, they oversaw dozens of executions, and they both are against it now.
This is the Reporter Roundtable on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we will continue in just a moment.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides in the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this week for our Reporter Roundtable, we have Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Hi again, Laura.
Hello again.
Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hannah News Service. Hi again, Shane.
Hello.
And Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks for being here, Sarah.
Of course.
And I did want to talk a little bit about immigration. Immigration officers are detaining people around the country and in Ohio suspected of being in the country illegally. The intensity of the effort remains a little bit cloudy. In Northeast Ohio, media outlets reported that 20 people were arrested at a Cleveland Heights taco restaurant. There are reports of some detentions here in Central Ohio, but there's not been any high-profile raids. Has there been talk about this at the State House? Are lawmakers, you know, aware and thinking about how Ohio fits in on this whole federal immigration issue?
They absolutely are. I think it's important to note first and foremost that the state government has very little to do with immigration policy. The federal government oversees most immigration policy and kind of has that like superseding arrangement that it's their policy to direct. That being said, you have seen proposals like Representative Josh Williams' proposal. He proposed it last legislative session. I think he just proposed it again, that it punishes cities for not complying with the federal government when it comes to immigration orders, and it adds a monetary penalty for noncompliance. So you do see things like that, kind of lawmakers proposing bills that you have to abide by what the federal government says, but you lawmakers really have little power in this arena.
Right, right. And Springfield gained national attention because of the lies about the Haitian community. I talked on a show last week with a resident there, and he said he is preparing his community for the inevitable. He said, you know, Springfield obviously is on the president's radar, so he was offering advice on what people and Haitians in Springfield should say and not say if they're approached by an officer. Laura, do you think that with Do you think Springfield is going to be something that the federal government has its eye on since it was such a hot button issue?
Most likely. The Haitian immigrants are here under a program called Temporary Protected Status, TPS.
TPS, yeah.
And the president just ended that for Venezuelans. And so, you know, I would anticipate that he might end it for other immigrants from other countries, in which case, you know, there's a lot of companies in the Springfield-Clark County area that employ these immigrants who are here legally under that TPS program in their businesses. And so it's going to have an impact on the families, the Haitian families, but also on the community and on businesses overall.
And our now senior senator, Bernie Moreno, senior senator for,
by two, we- two
by
weeks.
About 2 weeks yeah. over Senator John Husted, he said on the campaign trail that he, I believe TPS status for Haitians is up in 2026, and he certainly wants to see the federal government end that. Republicans argue that this temporary protective status has been abused by Democrats. It's been extended and extended, and so you definitely could see, like Laura said, I think 2026 is the date that, like, right now it is the law that they have this protective status until a certain date in 2026, but come 2026, I don't see an extension under the Trump administration.
Not to say that the Trump administration will wait till 2026. I mean, he's done executive orders on a lot of things.
Absolutely. And yeah. I think that's, I mean, when you get into the executive orders and also a situation like this, I mean, I think that's the question, because Moreno was saying, you know, they've got this status till 2026, but come 2026, we're going to change that. So I don't know the legality of overriding something like that, but
I do think that the level of fear and attention to immigration and raids has been elevated by the Trump administration. I think that it's kind of flexing muscle to show immediate action on a campaign promise to rein in illegal immigration. But I don't know that the number of deportations is going to it might return to like the Obama level. And you know, President Obama was called the deporter in chief for a long time.
Yeah, it's so vital to note that both parties deport immigrants.
Yeah.
And like, I think
it's just whether or not it becomes a news story depends on that. Yeah.
I think there is a lot of misinformation out there too. I mean, it's been really hard, and I'm not covering immigration like super aggressively, but it's been really hard. You see people saying, oh, well, there was ICE, you know, there were ICE agents at this restaurant. And, you know, in the age of social media, anyone can say anything. And ICE has always had a presence in Columbus. Like, they have a field office in Westerville. It's not a new thing. But with the change in administration, there definitely is, I think, this picture that there is this huge, huge increase in deportations.
We haven't seen much talk about, you know, punishing businesses that employ undocumented workers. There's a lot of thought that that would you know, really, you know, really maybe.
Who would punish, like the state or the federal government?
The federal, the federal government saying you're employing undocumented workers. Mm-hmm. That's illegal. We're gonna fine you. We're gonna shut you down. We're gonna do X, Y, or Z.
That's another piece that the state legislature can play a role in. And I can't, someone fact check me if they passed the E-Verify bill last year. I can't
remember if that passed or not, but
it got pretty far. But there was a bill that required companies over a certain number to put all their employees through a more stringent check of their legal status in the state to work.
Okay, well, I'm sure, you know, immigration will continue to come up, just depends on when and where. So another bill that I wanted to highlight is being called the Higher Education Bill. It's also known as Senate Bill 1. It's a bill to overhaul higher education in the state, and it's already had a hearing. The bill will do a number of things, but the larger mission is to crack down on the so-called liberal ideology on public university campuses. Shane, this bill seems like it's being fast-tracked.
It is being fast-tracked. The chair of the committee that's hearing it, Senator Christina Rogner, is from the Akron area. Summit County has said that she's going to hold multiple hearings on it. I mean, you've already seen one. It's Senate Bill 1. Usually a high-priority bill gets the first bill of any new General Assembly. And Senator Serena, who's the sponsor of the bill, said, we've already pretty much heard this bill last session. It will still give people the chance to come in and testify on it and give their opinions of it. But he argues it's pretty much the same bill. We already know what it is. So it's probably going to move through the Senate pretty fast. And now that you have Matt Huffman as the Speaker of the House, he's, you know, he was in charge of the Senate that passed it last time. And there's going to probably be less opposition among the caucus, enough to keep it from coming to the floor. So it will probably get passed, and I wouldn't be surprised by the summer.
The bill does a lot of things. I mean, I could laundry list so many things in the bill. It bans diversity, equity, and inclusion at universities. It shortens trustees' terms from 9 years to 6 years. It mandates a civics course that includes American history and learning about the Constitution. It bans faculty strikes. I'll stop there with my laundry list, but the bill has met my protests. I saw a news release, Shane, where it was saying that the student group who was at the State House said that they had more people and they were louder than the supporters. But were you there covering it? Did you hear?
I was there when they relaunched it. And yes, there was a contingent of students out in the hallway chanting very loudly, almost drowning out the press conference when it began. I think a sergeant at arms went out and told them to quiet down and told them that they couldn't be there because they had to have a permit, which I'm not sure if is true. But they did, I think, kind of move out into the rotunda for a little bit. They would kind of get loud, and then they would kind of quiet down again, and then they would get loud again. So I can't say there were a ton of supporters there during the re-rollout of it, but the, you know, opponents are a lot more vocal about this.
Yeah. So, I mean, there'll be more hearings, but
there'll definitely be more hearings, and some of the things that were more controversial from the last sessions, such as banning faculty from striking, that's back. As Serena said, you know, a lot of these things he gave up was to get compromise on it in the House, and the House didn't compromise on passing the bill, so he's just going to bring everything back. And then he's added a few things, like you mentioned, the Board of Trustee terms. I think there's going to be some required training for Board of Trustee members and so on and so forth.
You know, the idea of banning faculty strikes, just want to point out that it's pretty unusual. I think the last time that happened was at Wright State University in 2019.
And I mean, it does remain to be seen, although this bill is definitely on a fast track, and Serino says he's not going to make compromises. Compromises are how legislation gets done. And, you know, there are Republicans with universities in their districts where, you know, this bill was not, I mean, there were more opponents than there were proponents last legislative session. That's likely going to be true this time around. But, you know, it's hard to say right now if, although leadership is definitely more supportive in both chambers this time around, it's hard to say if some lawmakers may not take issue with some of the pieces that were added back in. I would namely, say, the faculty strike issue, because they're going to get a lot of grief from the unions.
This is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable on All Sides. We're talking with Laura Bischoff of the Columbus Dispatch, Shane Stegmiller of Hannah News Service, and Sarah Donaldson from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. In the minutes that we have left, I wanted to just talk a little bit about the musical chairs going on in different seats, just the different people who have announced that they're running for different offices. So Keith Faber has announced that he is going to run for attorney general. That's a job currently held by Dave Yost. Dave Yost announced he's running for governor. So, I mean, I guess that just happens every 2 to 4 years. Everyone wants a new seat.
Yeah, every 4 years, actually every 4 to 8 years, mm-hmm. because term limits keep executive officers at 8 years max in the seat they have. So the governor's race, it's going to be Dave Yost. Probably expect to hear Robert Sprague, the current mm-hmm. treasurer, will probably announce. Vivek Ramaswamy is expected to jump in. So that'll be a hot primary. And then, I don't know who's going to run for auditor and treasurer. We haven't heard much there. Niraj Antani, who's a former state senator from the Dayton area, he's announced for Secretary of State. He might get a primary as well. It is kind of musical chairs, particularly on the GOP side. The Democrats have a smaller bench, and so we really haven't heard anything about who's running, other than Amy Acton, who mm-hmm. announced as a Democrat for governor.
There's a man named Brian Hambly who I believe has announced he's running for Secretary of State as well. But it's
he is running as a Democrat for Secretary of State, and he's a cancer doctor, right?
Yeah, you've kind of got the doctor tickets. I mean, they're not on the same ticket, I should clarify, but they're both running as Democrats. And like Laura said, I mean, Democrats don't really have a front bench.
Dr. Amy Acton and now Dr. Brian.
Yeah, they don't really have a front bench, so they don't really have a back bench either. So you are going to see folks, I mean, especially in this last cycle where the last, one of the last remaining statewide elected Democrats, Sherrod Brown, obviously lost. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to take a lot of convincing for Democrats to put their name forward for statewide office.
And it's interesting to see among the Democrats if that's going to be kind of a strategy of putting forth candidates who one of their main arguments for electing them is, I'm not a career politician. I'm not entwined in state government. I haven't been connected to any of these controversies. Give us a chance because we're going to come in with fresh eyes and fresh, ideas.
Yeah, I did see a press release from Brian Hambly. He announced that he raised more than $350,000 in 31 days. That seems like a lot for the Secretary of State race, right? I don't know.
he's the only guy who's put his... I mean, of course, Niraj Antani in the GOP field, and he's likely mm-hmm. to face a primary challenger, but he's the only guy who's put his name out there. And the Democrats have to do that. I mean, Democratic sources tell me they got to get their name out there sooner rather than later, because mm-hmm. if you have a situation like... with Brian Hambly, I mean, it's not like he's a name that's known statewide. He doesn't have Sherrod Brown or Tim Ryan name recognition. Mm-hmm. So the sooner they put their name out there, the better. But yeah.
I'll point out that in Ohio, there's only one Democrat holding statewide elected office right now, and that's Jennifer Bruner.
Mm. Yeah. So do you? I mean, not that you can make predictions, but are there any names out there of other Democrats besides Amy Acton that are going to throw their hat into the ring for governor?
I would look at some of the different mayors around mm-hmm. the state. You've got Aftab Perival down in Cincinnati. You've got the Cleveland mayor.
Justin Bibb.
I don't know if they're interested. I haven't heard mm-hmm. whether they are, but usually that's where the Democrats reach out to, is to pull some local officials when they're... statewide bench is a little shorter.
Yeah. House Minority Leader Allison Russo hasn't said what she's running for yet. At one time, her name was thrown out as a maybe governor candidate, but she's the savvy politician, and she's run for Congress before, so mm-hmm. There are other places she could see herself going. And again, she has name recognition in Columbus, but it's hard to say if she has name recognition outside of the state house for those of us who are not glued to Capitol Square.
Yeah. And Dave Yost is running for governor on the Republican side, and he has officially announced, and he kind of came out against Costco this past week too. I'm not sure if anybody did anyone cover that?
I wrote about it. He signed a letter with, I think, about 18 other Republican attorneys general across the state or across the country saying, hey, drop your DEI policies or explain to us why you have not. It's interesting because, like, people love their Costco.
Yeah. Don't mess with Costco.
Don't mess with Costco.
If you don't, yeah, especially if you're running for governor, you're going to have people, you know, all these ads with his face in Costco now.
It's not totally surprising, though. He's been definitely very vocal on the diversity, equity, and inclusion issue. You know, there was an order that came down about scholarships at universities, quote unquote, DEI scholarships, and he was very supportive of the fact that you know, recent federal rulings mean they need to be ended. So, you know, he's definitely been vocal on this issue for a while.
All right. And go ahead. Yeah.
I was just going to say, and with Vivek possibly entering the race and possibly getting the backing of, like, J.D. Vance and President Trump, and that Yost has got to make a name for himself.
Well, we're down to a minute, and I was going to bring up that we still don't have a lieutenant governor, but we'll just save that for next time. Maybe we will have a lieutenant governor in a week from now. So thank you for joining us for the Weekly Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. Thanks to Laura Bischoff with the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
And Shane Stegmiller with Hannah News Service. Thank you, Shane.
Thank you for having me.
And Sarah Donaldson from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks, Sarah.
Always good to be here.
This is All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News.